Good morning and welcome back to the BRN Weekly Podcast. I'm Jeff Snyder. I'm your host. And that's right, we have a new name, but it's still the same old. We're members of academia, financial services, and the media come together to analyze the news in retirement, markets, technology, personal finance, and so much more. Our contributors are chomping at the bit. And you know what? Today begins National Retirement Security Week. Bet you didn't know that. For us here on the program, it's always Retirement Security Week, helping Americans save for their future and gain financial independence. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode of the BRN Weekly Podcast. Well, it's time to start with the show, as we always do, with a look at the latest social media trends. And joining me on the line, Devin Banerjee. He's the Senior Financial Services Editor for LinkedIn. Good morning, Devin. How are you?
I'm doing great, Jeff. How are you?
I'm doing quite well. And, you know, if you weren't aware, today, Sunday, begins National Retirement Security Week, all the way through Saturday of this week. So, yay! Bet you weren't aware of that.
I was not specifically aware, but as you say, Jeff, every day to us is a day for retirement trends and news. So,
absolutely,
always on my mind.
Absolutely. Well, thanks. So what's top of mind for you and the readers and the community known as LinkedIn?
Absolutely. So a couple items that really sparked a very passionate conversation last week on the platform. The first are actually two studies we featured about this great diversity conundrum, the fact that there are not enough women in senior and executive positions here in America, but what can happen when women are in those roles. Mm-hmm. So the first study was from S&P Global Market Intelligence, looking at chief financial officers in particular. And S&P found that against a control group, companies with women in the CFO seat see profits growing by an average of 6% over those in the control group, and improving stock returns by 8% over the control group within 2 years of that woman being appointed to the CFO seat. So the study suggests that, you know, women are held to higher standards, which mm-hmm. anecdotally we hear quite a lot, that they feel they need to prove themselves in their job. They may work harder, work smarter, they may be more productive. And again, despite their success, despite this data, women are still underrepresented in those executive positions and in the CFO role, outnumbered by about 6.5 to 1 here in America. The other study we featured on this topic was from Credit Suisse. It found that companies that have more than 20% of top managers as women see their share prices rise more over the over a decade-long period compared with the control group. And that actually applied also to family-owned businesses mm-hmm. Or also to companies with at least one female executive in those family-owned companies. And so a lot of people are pointing at this, again, as evidence that women are lacking in those positions and companies are losing out, and owners of companies, shareholders are losing out because of this big gap here in corporate America.
Yeah. I mean, the numbers in the control group just pan out. How much of this, Devin, you know, we always believe in diversity of opinion. You know, when you have the same type of people in the room, you get, you know, kind of that, I forget what they call it, but, you know, you kind of get the same mindset. And I think having that diversity, we talk about on the show all the time, you and I offline, how important it is to include all different type of people. How much does that, is that represented here? I mean, obviously these women, I mean, first thing I when I heard those numbers, you know, 6-7% over their male counterparts, I'm like, you're hired. You're hired. Because I want to earn 6-7% more of a return on my investment, or I want to be 6-7% more profitable. But how much of that is just attributable to people who are open-minded, you know, CEOs, CFOs that are open-minded to including people with just really good ideas, great ideas.
Yeah, the attribution in these studies is a bit difficult to really pin down. Obviously, the numbers are easier to figure out, but the research on that term I think you're looking for, called groupthink, mm-hmm. has really been clear for decades now that groupthink is dangerous, that groupthink leads to suboptimal decision making. Mm-hmm. But other people point to other issues, as I mentioned, that that women are held to a higher standard, which sounds like a bad thing, but actually could translate into good results. Other people wonder, you know, does greater diversity lead to better business models, more reliable, responsible, maybe risk-averse business models? Or maybe it's the other way around. Maybe those business models lead to managers who are open to diverse thought and opinion, and therefore more women come into those companies. So attribution is pretty difficult. There's this chicken and egg question a lot. But I think it's just clear that for those who are in hiring positions or decision-making positions in companies, that attracting diversity is just good. The data proves that out.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you cannot argue with if you're all a quantitative person, you can't argue with the numbers.
Right.
I mean, they just bear out. And I think the more and more, if you go to, even if you don't go to business school, it's just if you go to, you're in a social club, or you're, you know, part of a band or whatever, you're just part of a group, it helps to have a different group of people, a mix of people. You get different thoughts of ideas. The idea of uniformity of just one type, I think you just, you know, you do get that group think, and I don't think you get as, you're not as successful. Obviously.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad you mentioned business school, Jeff, because the next topic, great segue.
Oh, thank you.
Is a real coming together of different trends that you and I have talked about on this segment and offline over time. So, you know, the headline is really that MBA programs and elite MBA programs are seeing a huge, huge drop off in applications. Mm. So data from the Graduate Management Admission Council shows that applications to top U.S. MBA programs fell 9.1% this year. That's almost by a tenth.
Wow.
After dropping 7% in 2018. And a lot of the reasons behind it, as I mentioned, are really trends that are top of mind today. So one, of course, is international affairs and political tensions related to immigration here to the U.S. Visa rules, et cetera, have gotten a bit tougher, obviously, under this current administration in the U.S., but also other issues. I mean, in this tight labor market, there is an availability of high-paying jobs that don't require business degrees, a much higher volume of those jobs than in the past. There are also people, as you and I talk about all the time, who are seeing a path to good, high-quality employment without taking on more student debt or taking on student debt for the first time. Elite MBA programs are, for lack of a better term, notoriously expensive. They're very, very expensive if you think about the top programs. So, as I said, a good kind of coming together of different trends that we've talked about that are really squeezing this once, and I think you mentioned it for this reason, it really was once a pillar of going into corporate America and climbing the corporate ladder is to have that MBA. I believe you have an MBA, and I know we've talked about in the past. My parents both have MBAs.
Yeah.
But I think it really is losing a bit of its power today. One good thing that people pointed out in our conversation on the platform is that, hey, the odds of acceptance are starting to look a bit better at some of these really tough schools.
Yeah, I was going to say, it used to be a rite of passage. You know, you go to grad school, or you go to grad school after you go to get your bachelor's or bachelor's of science or whatever to pursue a master's. I think, to your point, kind of passe now. I was going to ask you, remember, I think it was 2 weeks ago. So last week, I think it was the Byte. We were talking about coding, I think, at some point on the network. I think you also mentioned how there was a rural desert in terms of medical schools, and some medical schools like Cornell and Columbia were actually working on endowments to encourage people, you know, to pay those $200,000 medical expenses. And I guess where I'm getting to very wordily is I wonder if some of those business schools, as Harvard Business, and are thinking about maybe doing something similar to attract the future leaders in this world.
Yeah, I think we've seen across the board, both at the graduate level and the undergraduate level, definitely an increase in aid and tuition. A lot of that geared toward ensuring more diversity of the student population in these schools. So I absolutely think that could help attract those who are concerned about the cost. But at the same time, those other trends I mentioned are really allowing young people with just bachelor degrees to have good, high-paying jobs. And so these trends are kind of competing. But you make a good point about the medical schools, which we've talked about, mm-hmm. which is that one effect of the expense of those programs is that people stay, you know, people are led to different areas of the country where they can earn a lot in order to pay off that expense. And that results in those medical deserts in rural areas around the country where there's like one doctor for two or three counties. So some really powerful knock-on effects of the high cost of higher education.
Yeah, I think that one of the biggest things that I can think of is you talk to people and just the student loan debt. I mean, who wants to walk around and pay off your student loan debt at 40 yeah. years, at 40, 45 years old? If you want to start a family, buy a home, you know, I think that's a real lot. That's a lot of headwind. So I guess we have to see really interesting trends, and I'm sure the source of much discussion on the community this week. Devin, always a pleasure talking with you. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll see you again bright and early tomorrow morning for BRN AM. Thanks again so much, and we'll talk to you soon.
Sounds good, Jeff. Take care.
Bye. Welcome back. Now we're going to shift gears, talk a little technology and consumer products. Joining me on the line from Orlando, Florida today is Mr. Daniel Klein. He's a senior technology and consumer products reporter with The Motley Fool. Hi, Daniel. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well. And I want to. Today is the beginning of National Retirement Security Week. So, you know, at least when this airs, so that would be Sunday. It's the start of the week, and it goes all the way through Saturday. So I wasn't sure if you were aware of that, but if you weren't, you are.
I am now. It's surprisingly not on any of my calendars.
I know. It's just, well, for us here on the network, every day is saving for retirement or your financial independence. So we don't necessarily, you know, we think every day is National Retirement Security Day week. But be it that as it may, a lot going on in the technology and consumer product space. So what are you going to lead off with?
So let's talk about something that costs you money but can save you money. Netflix.
Okay.
So at this point, it is fair to say you can cut your cable subscription and replace it with maybe a $25 Sling TV live TV subscription and a $13 Netflix subscription. If you're a T-Mobile customer, T-Mobile will cover most of the cost of that Netflix subscription if you have a family plan. And the reason we're talking about Netflix is they just reported earnings and they had a sort of bounce back quarter. And I go back to some things I wrote when they had their last quarter, and everyone, the sky is falling. Netflix missed its subscriber totals. And in their call, they said, yeah, we mistimed some of what we thought. Everything we thought we were going to gain in this quarter will make up in the next quarter. And that's more or less what happened. So when you look at Netflix, this isn't a quarter-to-quarter company. They're pretty much a mature business in the U.S. They only added about 500,000 subscribers because they have, I don't know the
everybody.
Exact number. Yeah, they have everybody. It's 80 million people. It's
wow.
You know, there's just not a lot of room to grow there. But globally, they're just in the absolute beginning days of building their customer base. So they're at about 159 million people globally, and there's no reason to believe they won't grow to 200 million. And the great thing as an investor in Netflix is whenever they get to the point where they sort of have all the customers that they reasonably think they're going to get, and they move into that sort of like we're going to grow by 3-5% a year as opposed to 20-30%, they can cut content costs because right now they need to throw a lot at the wall, see what sticks.
Yeah.
If you look at what HBO is doing, which HBO is a mature company, HBO only needs to have one show at a time that you or I are watching and we'll keep HBO. So admittedly, this is a low period for HBO because the Game of Thrones has ended and they don't have a hot signature show right now. But I know I keep HBO solely because I watched Last Week Tonight. Netflix my wife is a bigger fan than I am, but she always has something she's watching. So there's no scenario where I'm going to cut Netflix. It's gravy if they add 60 movies I want to watch or launch a new show I want. But as long as there's something when I open up that app for me to tune into, whether it be a new comedy special, a new show, whatever it is, I'm going to stay a subscriber. So right now, they're in a tremendous period of spending. And slowly over time, that's going to subside.
Yeah, absolutely. They're spending billions upon billions of dollars. Let me ask you a question in terms of Netflix. I mean, I think they pretty much have everybody that they're going to have in the United States. When do they look at some of the developing or emerging markets? I mean, don't some of those economies have cell phones and digital towers and the ability to stream like we do? So wouldn't that be an area for future customers?
So I think there's plenty of countries they're not in that they could be in. And you have to look at the culture in a country. I'll give sort of a bizarre example. In the United States, for a long time, pay-per-view was a big way people consumed boxing and pro wrestling. So, you'd watch pro wrestling on TV for 3 months, and at the end of the 3 months, there'd be WrestleMania, and you'd pay $60 for it. Well, that type of programming has never been a thing in Japan. So even though Japan is a very big market for professional wrestling and combat sports in general, pay-per-view has not worked well there. So you have to look at a country, say an India or even China, though there's regulatory barriers to getting into China. You have to look at how the consumers spend money and whether you're going to be offering a product that has to educate people to buy a certain way. And that's partly how they're making their choices. Is the infrastructure there? A lot of countries have what we would consider 2G internet. So the default is a service that's not going to work particularly well with Netflix. I've been in the Bahamas and tried to live stream TV on my phone, specifically the Women's World Cup, and it didn't go well. It is a very poor experience. So if you're in a hotel that offers high speed, maybe you're in okay shape, but if you're sitting in a public place just trying to watch something, it isn't going to work. So they have to scale their expansion toward the ability of people to watch it. And I do think there is still tremendous growth in the U.S. There were, cables down to about 90 million homes, from like 95, 96 million. So Netflix can still add that. And I think there is a bigger audience than there ever was for cable simply because it's a low price point. And yeah, there's whole economies that don't have Netflix that will eventually be places that give the company 10, 15 million subscribers.
Any risk from to Netflix? And I agree with you. I think it's really hard to look quarter to quarter at a company because I think you've got to take the long. We talk about this on the network. We talk about on this show in terms of just thinking about things. You got to take the long approach. You can't just say one quarter is a trend. But are there any other companies out there? I mean, what is the Disney Plus endeavor or the ESPN Plus or the bundling that they're going to do with Hulu? What kind of impact does that have? What is Amazon? What are they cooking up? I mean, or Apple? What are they all cooking up? And could they take market share?
So I think Disney Plus is actually going to help Netflix, maybe not in the first quarter, but if you look at what's out there as a cable customer, and again, there's still 90 million homes paying for cable. If you look and say, well, if I cut the cord, can I get everything I want? The ability to have Netflix, Disney Plus, and either Hulu Live or Sling TV, which would in total cost you about $60 compared to the $100 to $200 cable bill, that is going to cause more cord cutting in the long term. I think, younger families are probably going to lean towards Disney Plus if they have neither, but eventually kids get older and they're going to want both. So there are very few companies. Apple, look, I think Apple's throwing good money after bad by launching a content service. They could get the, in fact, they will be giving it to me for free because they have a thing where if you bought a new Apple product, you get it for a year. I can't imagine a scenario that makes me watch Apple. And I say that because I have Amazon. I have Amazon Prime, and there have been shows I was interested in on Amazon Prime TV. And because it's like fifth in my mind share, I almost never remember to look at them. So there's too much good TV, and the bigger players are going to win. And the amount of money it would take Apple to get anywhere near the Netflix or Disney library, is astounding. And Apple has that money, but not only do you have to spend money, you also have to have good luck. How many shows has Amazon put out that might get some critical acclaim, but nobody is watching? You know, I think the biggest shows on Amazon Prime are getting like 1 million viewers, which would get you canceled on most cable channels.
Yeah, absolutely. I would just say that there's a lot of content out there, and I wouldn't describe it all as great. I think a lot of it, I'd rather not watch a lot of it, to be honest. That's just my personal opinion. Let's shift gears now. I know you want to talk a little bit about retail and about Sears.
Yeah, so I want to issue another warning. Now, Sears has gone bankrupt. It's really a public company only in name only now. But when you look at a retail company, and I'll say this applies to JCPenney as well, it would probably apply to Barnes & Noble, but Barnes & Noble is no longer a public company. If you see year after year of losses and no major changes, don't listen to what the CEO says. So in this case, Eddie Lampert, the former CEO of Sears, is the CEO in everything but name. He controls and owns the company. They just closed another group of stores, and of course, he puts out the hopeful statements about how they're getting the business right and everything's going great. And I've joked about this, but he's going to be standing in the last Sears, closing it aisle by aisle until he's in the last aisle, closing it product by product, telling you that the turnaround is going to work and shop your way is some brilliant savior strategy. The reality is, Sears is a failed company that isn't coming back. And as a consumer, that should make you wary this holiday season about shopping there. And I hate to say this because there's still 30 or 40,000 people who work there, but what I'll say to those people is Target is hiring, Walmart is hiring, Amazon is hiring. Sears failed. They didn't make a digital change when they needed to make a digital change. And now it doesn't matter what merchandise they put on the shelves, and the reality is they're not putting enough merchandise on the shelves, that this is a case of a lightly scrutinized company can make headlines because it's a famous brand name, and you're seeing a lot of stories. Oh, this latest round of closures is going to do all these. No, these are the latest round, and 3 months from now, there will be another round. So don't get suckered in. And look, if you're buying something at Sears that you know fits and you know that after return, buy it at a clearance sale and that's great. If you're buying something at Sears as a Christmas gift that you might have to return, don't do that. Go to another store. I hate, again, I hate to be so dire, but I am not a big fan of CEOs or leaderships that have absolutely no plan who consider closing stores. If you're not growing, you're probably dying. And Sears is absolutely dying.
Yeah, I remember Sears at one point was the go-to for lawn equipment and tools and everything, and it's just kind of not that way anymore. It's really a shame. It's just an end of an era. Let me ask you a quick question, Daniel. What happens if you buy a gift at Sears? Say you buy that color TV, or you buy a dress, or not you in particular, but you buy a dress for your wife, and you need to return it, and Sears is closed. Do you go back to the manufacturer, or
So,
you're on the hook for it?
if you buy electronics, the warranty is often manufacturer provided.
Okay.
There is nothing less pleasant than having like a 6-month-old TV that you have to ship back to Sony to get repaired. But that is usually how it works. But that is something you want to check. Don't go buy jewelry for your wife if you don't know she's going to like it at Sears because they may not be there. Don't buy a gift card. As an individual store closes, that can just be an inconvenience. You could always drive to another Sears to make a return. When a chain closes, there's usually a liquidation sale, and they may or may not take gift cards. Sometimes there's a limited amount of time. In some cases, they sell off all their inventory to a liquidation company, and that company has no obligation to accept those gift cards. And another buyer beware thing, they often bring in merchandise that doesn't match the quality of the original store, leftover stuff from other places they've liquidated. So just because a Sears is being liquidated doesn't mean what you're buying is Sears quality. So be a little careful. And I know Sears quality sounds a little strange, but Craftsman tools are still quality tools. You can still buy Levi's jeans and other things that are meaningful name brands. But this is a scenario you don't want to be in. If you're breaking the bank to buy $225 sneakers as a gift for your sneakerhead kid, take him with you to make sure they fit, because you don't want him opening them up under the Christmas tree and putting them on and having to take them back and finding out that January 2nd the retailer closes. And I'm not saying that's what's going to happen to Sears. I'm just saying it's not out of the question.
Well, it's a good cautionary tale, considering we're about to go into Halloween, which means we're about to go into Thanksgiving thereafter, and it is the shopping season. People need to be wary about the status of retailers and not just be blind to that. Although I get the sense, Daniel, that a lot of people will be shopping online at the Targets, the Amazons, and other places, unless it comes to clothing. And even clothing, you can try on and return.
So we are going to see record numbers of online shopping. But to put this in perspective, and I'll do that because you're going to see headlines that say online shopping is bigger than brick and mortar. That is absolutely not true. Online shopping is about 13% of the total, and it is very possible that rises to 15, 16, let's even call it 20% this holiday season. Mm-hmm. But to make it equal, it's just not. Most people are still buying things in stores. Now, there's a lot of, call it omni-channel mixed shopping, where I'm looking at something online while I'm standing in front of it in the store because I can read reviews. There's a lot of buy online, pick up in store, buy online, return in store. And absolutely, I will do the vast majority of my shopping digitally because that's how I shop in general. That said, I went to the mall this weekend and I bought, well, two more of this shirt. We're on audio here, not video, so no one could see that. But I'm wearing a black polo shirt that I'm always wearing, and I own a stack of them. And I went to JCPenney to buy more because I'm concerned JCPenney won't be there in a few months. But the reality is, however you shop, think about where you're buying. You know, it's great to buy something handmade from an individual proprietor, but what happens when that shows up and it isn't what you think it is? So look at the terms, understand what you're getting, know everything about what you're doing, and realize that Walmart, Amazon, Target, I'll say Macy's, Best Buy, those are chains that are going to be there in 5 years. Sears, JCPenney, some of your other mall retailers, maybe not. You know, you have to worry about The Gap. That is a chain that is struggling. J. Crew, both chains which are spinning off more successful brands and that will be standing on their own as companies and not necessarily financially viable. So you might want to Google, you know, which companies might go bankrupt next year before you buy gift cards, before you buy things that may not fit the person.
Yeah, excellent advice, Dan. Really great advice, especially it's National Retirement Security Week this week. Thanks so much for joining us. Awesome insight into a lot more than just tech and consumer products. And you can catch Dan on Tuesday. We do a Tech Tuesday with Dan and the Motley Fool on BRN AM. Dan, I'll see you Tuesday morning, my friend.
I'll see you then.
Thanks. Bye. Welcome back, and now it's time to shift gears, talk a little markets, and I can think of no one better to do so than the lead anchor for the TD Ameritrade Network, Oliver Rennick. Hi, Oliver. How are you?
Yo, what's up, Jeff? Doing well, man.
Hey, it's great to talk to you, and I know markets go up, markets go down. Looks like markets go all around, and you know, kind of been reading your posts, following your shows when I can, when I'm not buried deep in working. So what's top of mind this week for you and your colleagues at TDA Network?
Well, it was a pretty nice week as we got within basically 1% of an all-time high. And then Friday, as we speak, things have gotten a little bit dicey. I wrote something earlier this week on my LinkedIn describing this as the two-faced market. Originally, I called it the Harvey Dent market, but then I guess some people didn't really know who that was, so I had to clarify a little bit. But basically, the reason why, apart from the fact that I've been casually reading Batman comics again, is that there really are like two sides to this market, and the really crucial point is that markets have been responding for the last 2 weeks to positive developments on the geopolitical front. Hopes that a Brexit deal might get signed this weekend, as thin as those hopes might be, the hopes have been enough to make big waves across some important asset classes. And then a couple of weeks back, of course, the phase one discussion between U.S. and China was also an easing of geopolitical concern. But here's the catch. Just like Harvey Dent, when there's good assumptions and assumption of good, there's actually a darkness into this that people are starting to really pick up on. And that is what happens when bonds sell off. And over the last month and a half now, some of the implications of a market where bonds and gold and assumptions about central bank cuts don't – go one direction. So here's what I mean. September, we talked about here on your podcast, there was a big sell-off in the bond market, really important thing because the bond market's just been so nonstop rally all year. Our data was looking pretty good, and the bond market sold off. At the same time, we saw a big sell-off in momentum names, software, and technology stocks. Now, that move then reversed itself. So this is a reversal of the trend that happened in September. But then we had our bad data at the first week of October. Mm-hmm. And then that all basically went the other way. Bonds rallied again. Gold rallied again. Expectations for central bank cuts went up again. And now we're at this moment where we don't really know what is on the other side of the door. But we've had some progress on the geopolitical front since then. The bond market has sold off again in the month of October. And with that, you say, okay, well, this is good geopolitical resolution. Yep. And the stock market as a whole has responded well. But you're having a big sell-off in some really important parts of the market that are probably tied to rates, but maybe just kind of had their back broken with the September sell-off, and that's the tech and the software stuff. And if that continues, there's probably going to be real ramifications, and it probably won't just happen in a vacuum because it's a big part of technology, and it suggests that investors are getting more particular about valuations mm-hmm. and about the earnings of companies, and that is going to be a big differentiator if it's a trend that starts. So there's a bit of a caveat even with good news in this market.
Yeah, let me ask you a question. It's earnings season, yeah. Obviously. Q3 earnings are out for Netflix. They reported a boost in earnings. You know, I kind of lump them in with technology. Maybe they're technology and media. Is that kind of what you're talking about? Does that help? You know, they were down in subscribers this year or this quarter, but they were up in terms of earnings.
Yep, great question. Great question. And the net result since their earnings is down. So Netflix was kind of a barometer for risk taking and froth in the market for the last 3 or 4 years. So when Netflix broke from its upward trend in 2018, that was a big deal here. And then it came back this year up until its second quarter earnings, where it sold off big time. And since then, it's been downtrending. And this earnings, even with the progress on some fronts and stability sort of in their user growth that was encouraging, that they're not slowing as much as people thought, this thing sold right off anyways, down 5.5% on Friday, partially wrapped up in what I'm discussing. So Netflix had a really bad month of September too. Mm-hmm. So yes, it is tied. It is an expensive company whose, you know, path for growth is now under question from competition. So it's a little bit more company specific for Netflix,
yeah.
But it is symptomatic of what happens in an expensive market, because the market still is expensive by just about every metric. Not all metrics, but by most metrics, right. On a trailing basis, still pretty elevated. And you never know when these things break. You never know when the market decides, when Mr. Market decides to stop paying as much as it did the day before for mm-hmm. each dollar of earnings. And it seems what we're seeing is that the discretion sort of investors is getting a little bit more acute, and they're a little less willing to pay up extremely high valuations for companies. And this kind of goes with WeWork too in the private market. That probably scared people a little bit. So
let me ask you another question. You talked about geopolitical mm-hmm. concerns ebbing slightly, bonds selling off. What about, you know, part of that is probably tied to the, it looks like we've come to some sort of agreement between the U.S. and China, but China's economic growth has softened and challenges are mounting. How does that play into some of this macro market dynamic?
Well, it's pretty tricky because we don't really know, right? And nobody knows what's going on between these two world leaders. Nobody knows what's going on between, you know, Boris Johnson and Varadkar in Ireland. You know, like, my point on the show has been basically, you can't play psychologist, right? And this has kind of come back to the two-faced nature of the market. You don't really know what you're going to get. You know, flip a coin, basically. And the catch is that kind of both sides of the coin are a little bit dicey, where if you don't get geopolitical resolution, well, that's not going to be good for company earnings. And that's not going to be good for the outlook overall for growth. But if you do, that might be encouraging from an economic side to still give us some runway in the global economy if it improves sentiment. But it also means that a lot of these trades that have been surefire winners are going to come under pressure. So it's a little bit of a catch-22. But as far as the geopolitical progress goes, you know, all that matters really is if companies start spending again. And so far, we're not seeing great evidence of that after this phase one deal, but we're going to get an answer to that in earnings. We're going to hear guidance. Important thing this week is that a lot of the industrial names had a good stock action post earnings, not because their numbers were big on an annual basis, but because they weren't as bad as expectations were. So this still remains a market where people have very low expectations for both the economy and economically sensitive stocks.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And now we're headed into the holiday season, right? When people are going to go out and buy gifts. I mean, now I'm thinking about taking it down to the micro, but now they're going to go buy gifts. They're going to buy shop on Amazon, Target. They're going to go. Yeah, absolutely. But it seems like, you know, and I don't think there's a correlation per se, but, you know, the U.S. consumers seem to remain optimistic. And I don't know if that's just, you know, they just got rose colored glasses on or, you know, just American optimism.
Yep. It's a really good question, and a good point, because that really has been the bedrock of this last 8 months of the economy, which has been the action of the American consumer and the health of the American consumer. This past week, we saw a little bit of departure from that narrative because we had a soft batch of consumer numbers in retail sales and Redbook. Now, confidence, to your point, does remain high by sentiment measures. It's ebbed a little bit from some of the records we've had, but this is why I think the level of the S&P 500 is so important and why a potential sell-off in some of these high-momentum, popular retail trades like software, if they continue selling off, that's not going to be good for sentiment. Yeah. And last year, we saw what a market sell-off can do for retail activity around the holiday season, and it very well could put it on ice. And if the American consumer goes on ice and there's not enough rebound in the rest of the world, you're probably looking at a heightened chance of recession.
Yeah. So, Oliver, if this is a Harvey Dent market, does that make you Batman?
Maybe that's what I was doing, just, you know, paint myself as the good guy here. Well, that's what's great about it, though, is because, you know, Harvey Dent and Two-Face is a product of Batman's negligence, really.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's why this market is interesting, because, you know, high valuation companies are too expensive or only our own fault.
That's right. I love how he turned it around on me. Well, Oliver, thank you so much. Enjoy your weekend, and we'll talk to you hopefully next week.
All right. Sounds good, Joe.
Thanks,
buddy.
Bye. Welcome back. And now we're going to shift gears, talk a little bit about retirement and more. Joining me on the line, she is the retirement reporter for Dow Jones Market Watch, Ms. Alessandra Melito. Hey, Allie, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing quite well. Welcome back. I know you're out, maybe not on vacation, but doing some fun stuff. So glad to have you back on the program. What's top of mind this week for you and the folks at MarketWatch?
Yeah, so this week started open enrollment for Medicare, which is a hot topic for those 65 and older. So right now, you know, there's always the initial enrollment period for people who are turning 65 to join Medicare. But between October 15th and December 7th, there are, you know, that's the time called open enrollment when people can switch their health coverage. And there are so many options that they can choose from. So there's obviously original Medicare, which is the Part A and Part B for hospital inpatient care and doctor visits and stuff like that. There's Part D, which is prescription coverage. Mm-hmm. But then there is Part C, which is Medicare Advantage. And Medicare Advantage is through a private insurance company, and they vary by state. So all states have different number of plans. So like in Alaska, I can't remember offhand, but like say you had like 70 in Alaska, like in New York, you'll have like 236 or something like that. So there are many plans that you need to take into consideration, many options. And then on top of that, there's also Medigap, which is separate from Medicare Advantage, and that's also known as like supplemental coverage, and that's supposed to fill in the gaps that original Medicare has for us, for an individual in particular. So I looked at some of the different options and things that you should know before you make your switch. So like instead of running to make your change just because maybe you're not happy with the Medicare plan that you have, mm-hmm. it's important to take into consideration a few things. The first being your actual health. So this is a really good time to do a health assessment where you like how your health is now, what you expect for your care in the next 12 months. If you have a chronic illness, you should take note of not only what that chronic illness is and your, the needs associated with that illness, such as like medication or physical therapy or something, but also like what might change in 12 months. Because you're, you know, once this period is over, you begin your coverage in January, and you have a disenrollment period for I think like a month and a half for Medicare Advantage. But mm-hmm. after that, you know, you kind of find yourself in a little bit of a pickle. So look at your health, talk to your doctors, do stuff like that. Also take into consideration the doctors that you do have. So different plans mean different networks, different healthcare providers. If you go to a Medicare Advantage plan, that Medicare Advantage plan may not accept your doctor. So if you have somebody that you're very loyal to, it's very important that you talk to them now and figure out what they accept and what that would look like if it was out of network, because Medicare Advantage is much more restrictive. And it also, there are different like facilities that they may not even accept. So I spoke to one advisor whose client was moving from South California to North California, and he said that the client hadn't considered the fact that his plan, if he were to switch, wouldn't have accepted a certain facility. Like, there were no facilities in that area of Northern California, so he'd have to travel hours to get to the facility that he needed for his care. Wow. So you have to also look at geography, you know, what facilities, hospitals, doctors are in that neighborhood that you're living in. What else? Also costs, of course. You have to take into consideration your costs. Medicare Part A comes at no cost, but Medicare Part B, you have your premium, which is going to be about $144 in 2020. Wow. And Medicare Advantage varies. So does Medigap. Medigap is much more expensive. Medicare Advantage is less expensive. I think the average monthly premium for Medicare Advantage is expected to be about $23, but that does vary by state, and it can be more expensive depending on what plan you choose, or it could be less expensive. But the people that I spoke to said that the reason why it's less expensive is because it offers less, whereas Medigap covers a lot more, and that's why you could expect to spend hundreds to like $500.
Allie, thanks, Allie. Allie, just real quick, I mean, is this, you know, there are, as you said, hundreds of decisions to be made in particular to a particular person. Are there services or people, like you mentioned talking to advisors, are these financial advisors? Are these healthcare advisors? Are there people that are specifically trained to help walk you through this, what sounds like a very important decision at age 65 or older?
Yeah, so I would say, I mean, I spoke to financial advisors, but I would say that you should talk to your own healthcare providers. They might provide some insight, especially if you trust them. Mm-hmm. You should do some research on Medicare. Medicare's website has a lot to offer as far as like comparing and contrasting mm-hmm. the different aspects of these plans. And I'm sure there are healthcare providers, people who like are like consultants that you can find who can provide some sort of like insight as to what may be best for you. And that would definitely involve some sort of an assessment of mm-hmm. your health and your financial situation and, just tell you kind of like what you should expect for at least the next 12 months.
And this is a decision. So say you're married or have a partner, each person in the relationship makes their own decision. Is that correct?
I believe so. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So it's a big decision, and it's one that if you're single, it's difficult. If you're married, it's a little bit more tricky, or have a partner, it's a little bit more tricky because you got to figure out who is covered by what, how, who, and then how it's going to work together for your combined budget. So really big decision. It's just one of those, you cover this space a lot, Allie, and you know, making decisions around Social Security, budgeting, and now this open enrollment, very, lots of things that key decisions that have to be made for people. So people have to do their due diligence, do their work. And that's why putting themselves in the best position financially is so important.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, Allie, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it. Wish you the best for the weekend, and we will talk to you very soon.
All right, talk to you soon.
Bye, Al.
Bye.
Welcome back, everyone. And we're going to shift gears and talk to the Legal Eagles, David Levine and Kevin Walsh, both principals with Groom Law, who are in an undisclosed location today. Gentlemen, how are you?
We are great, Jeff. I would almost say we are in a bunker at this point.
Very cool. So what's top of mind this week? I know you're short on time, but there's so much going on in Washington and in the regulatory environment. So do tell.
Yeah. So in the past kind of week and a half, there's been some pretty big updates in the regulatory environment. And it's not something at the Department of Labor, where we are expecting a rule on e-disclosure any day now. But kind of the real big regulatory development is that the president signed two executive orders last Thursday, which are kind of designed to kind of have agencies slow their roll on issuing sub-regulatory guidance or pursuing enforcement. So what does this mean to people? What's the big picture here? First off, the idea is that, you know, if the agency wants to tell the public or wants to tell the regulated community what it has to do, the executive orders tell the agency essentially, you know, go through notice and comment, give the public a chance to be involved in making sure that any requirements are workable. And then the other aspect of it is that it says, you know, and if you do rulemaking in a way where you're just providing an update to the public and it's not a notice and comment thing, so you post something on your website, you issue a field assistance bulletin, you send an internal memo that's designed to kind of explain the department's position or an agency's position, the executive order says, you know, don't use that as a basis for enforcement. You know, the idea is the agency can tie its own hands without notice and comment. But if it wants to tie the hands of the regulated community, it's got to give them an opportunity to speak about it. Now, how these get implemented, each agency has to look at the executive order. So the Department of Labor will look at it. Treasury will look at it separately. HHS will look at it separately. They'll all determine what that means to them. And absent kind of the White House or OMB really taking an active stance, the agency's interpretation of it will likely stick. So it kind of remains to be seen how big an impact this will have. But the interesting thing here is that before these executive orders came out, the Treasury Department had already released an internal memo saying the same thing. So here, the agency to really pay attention to is less Treasury, but more focus on how the Department of Labor interacts with this, what HHS does. So that kind of remains to be seen. But this is a pretty significant development because it essentially provides – it's designed to provide some more procedural protection before you find yourself interacting with an unfriendly regulator.
David?
I think Kevin puts it really well. Let's take it down to sort of the ground level for a second here and try to weave it in. What does this mean? Well, for service providers, we all know that there's often questions and there's been some real benefits of, I'll call it, sub-regulatory guidance, where you get field assistance bulletins or other sort of interpretive positions, some of which related to the fiduciary rule. This might impact the volume we get on there, which some would like, some might not like. Similarly, for the service providers, there's also enforcement. Enforcement has obviously been very active, and I think it's important to recognize that enforcement continues in a Democratic or Republican administration, and nobody is the owner of that. But it does also mean that in enforcement, how is enforcement going to work now, especially where there may not be guidance, what type of positions will be taken? A lot of folks have DOL investigations, and everybody's usually working to get to a positive outcome. And yes, it can get heated, but the goal is to get to an outcome. It'll be interesting to see how some areas, whether it be missing participants, ESOPs, or anything else, where does it all sort out? Because I think all sides want to resolve, but what does this do to that process is yet to be seen. On the sponsor side, you have similar type of discussions, but for sponsors, again, we'll have to see what this really means, and maybe it may mean, on some areas, you have less guidance, and you need to talk, well, I guess it's self-serving to your lawyers more because they can give you some guesses. So I guess we should thank the administration, and I'll close out on that.
Last 30 seconds, guys. I know you have to go. Any news? There was some media today about seven senators looking to pass the SECURE Act. Anything that you're hearing other than what we're reading in the paper about even coming close to passing something?
As I said,
well, we've actually been seeing more talk in the Senate on kind of Butch Lewis and more on the multis than SECURE at the moment. But that doesn't mean that SECURE is too much on the back burner.
SECURE is never insecure. It will be back. It is Groundhog Day, as we've said before. But I think at this point, anybody who poo-poos SECURE passing or someone who says it's going to pass, we just have to wait and see.
Yeah.
The politics involved here are just beyond the discussion of benefits. We have things like impeachment and judicial nominations. That's not about this community, but it influences us, and we'll have to see where it lands.
Absolutely. Well, gentlemen, thanks so much for stepping out of your meetings to join us. Enjoy the rest of your day. Have good meetings, and we'll talk to you all next week.
Thanks for having us on. It's always fun to participate.
Thanks
Jeff.
Thanks. Thank you so much.
Well, folks, that wraps up this episode of the BRN Weekly Podcast. Hope you found it enjoyable. Hope you learned something. Hope you recognize nothing changed, just the name. Thanks to our contributors, and thanks to you for spending time with us during your weekend. We know you're incredibly busy. And don't forget, check out BRN AM. That's our morning show. That starts at 8 a.m. Eastern Time, and it's also available via podcast. So if you're a subscriber, you'll get it automatically, so you can listen to it instead of seeing it. So until next week, I'm Jeff Snyder. We'll talk to you soon. Have a great rest of a week. Well, I'm peeping and I'm creeping, but I damn near got killed because my people kept peeping. Now it's time for